Especially where the voice from the cloud says, "This is my Son, the Beloved, for whom I am well pleased. Listen to him, Beloved." Have you in your life ever searched for being beloved? Where all and in what places do you find yourself trying to lean into the identity of being loved? Where do you seek and whom do you seek being loved from? You know, the beloved is not just an identity unique to one person being transfigured in a mountain in the book of Matthew. I think we can all in some way, in some deep, significant way, identify with the search of being loved, of being found to be lovable. To appear to someone else and that someone say back to us, "Boy, I am pleased by you." Rex, I don't know about you, but I like it when people are pleased by me. I think we look for this. We search for this. What places do you find that you are currently seeking to be loved or to be found with pleasure or to please someone? How long in your life, I won't call you out, Matt. Matt, how long in your life, how long in our lives have we longed for someone to say to us, "I love you"? And maybe you're not dating, maybe you're not married, and you're wondering. I have a friend in my life that texted me this week, messaged me this week. He's older, meaning he's not in high school, and he's trying to date. Dating is not going very well for him, and so he texted me, "What's wrong with me?" I think he was looking for someone. He's looking for someone to say, "I'm pleased by you. I love you." There was a time in my life. Has anyone ever said a bad word? Most of the kids are gone, so I'm going to be a little more naughtier today than I am usually. Kids are gone. Have you ever said a bad word in front of your parents? Oh, Lord have mercy. It's the worst. It's the worst. I was not raised in a home where bad words were used. I was raised in a home where to say bad words was to be living deep within sin. And so I'm not saying that's the wrong way to raise people. I'm saying that's just the way I was raised. But when I was in seminary, I was exploring myself, meaning I was exploring the language I was going to use as an adult as well. And so I was trying some things on, you know. Just seeing if they'd stick, you know. And I was with my dad. Most of you have met my dad. Bless his heart. He's a good man. I was with my mom and my dad in the Bravada on our way home from Newcastle, Indiana. And I was sitting in passenger seat, and dad was to my left and mom was right behind me. And I tried a word on for size. It did not go well, okay? It did not go well. The circumstance, he Dikembe Mutombo'd me. Do you know, have you seen the commercial? I think it's a Geico commercial. Dikembe Mutombo is a, yes. Yeah, he's a tall 7-foot center basketball player, and he rejects shots. And when he rejects the basketball, he then looks at the player that shot the ball that he rejected and goes, "Not in my house." Okay? Remember that. Remember that. So... in seminary, I was going through a rough stage. I was trying lots of things on for size to see if they would stick. And I was finding, another way to say this, Wendy, is I was looking for love in all sorts of places just to see if I would be loved by someone else. And just to reveal a little bit of my life to you, I didn't always make the best decisions, right? And I would say that they were good intention decisions. They were mostly decisions to where I would find acceptance or approval or someone to like me. I was never making decisions to be like, "Ooh, I'm going to spite my parents and spite God and live in rebellion." Maybe once or twice, but not often. Not often was that the motivator. Most often the motivator was I just wanted someone to like me, and I wanted to feel like I belonged, and I was trying to shed this. I'm just using this as a counseling session, I guess. I was just trying to shed the pastor's kid identity, you know. I was so tired of people always apologizing about the things they said because of my dad's profession. And now I'm in a profession where now people just apologize for the things they say because of who I am. I could never get away from it. And in seminary, I was trying to carve out my own identity, and I had made some really poor decisions. I think I shared this story, Bonnie, at MPH, and I had made some really bad decisions, and it was Thanksgiving weekend, and I was home, and I had made up my mind I was going to tell my parents about some of the decisions that I made, and about the consequences that they may carry for the rest of my life. And so I got up some courage when the lights went out, and it was dark on our way home from Newcastle. Kids like to talk when the lights go out, and so the lights are out, and I'm talking. And here it goes, baby, and I'm just letting it rip. And my dad is ticked, okay? I break the news to him, and I'm sure my life is going to end by him kicking me out of the Bravada going 65 miles an hour down the Indiana Highway. I know this is how it's going to end. He is so mad. My mom's crying. My mom not saying anything. She's just openly sobbing in the back seat. Okay? This is not going to plan, Jeff. And all I want is for some solace and for some comfort in my pursuit to find myself. And instead, my dad's enraged. My mom is openly crying. And I feel like a failure. And the only way that I could articulate my search in life to find something of meaning, but I can't find it, the only way I could articulate it is to tell my dad that I hate my fill-in-the-blank life. That's when I tried on that four-letter word for size. I said, Dad, I just hate my life. And my dad goes, No! Not my house! And that was that. And he just conveyed my tempo to me and shut that down. And I have never, ever used that word in front of him again. that was that. Ended that. We ended up in the living room that night. This was like a 3-hour conversation. Just my observations from this dark night. I would say that if I had a dark night of the soul, this was the start of it. This was it. This was day one. This was the beginning. And I would love to tell you that. I'm going to tell you like a soothing story, soothing part of the story now. But I don't want to pull any punches. Nothing got better this night. This went on for a really long time. And there are parts of what I'm about to tell you that are still unfolding in my life. I don't ever want to give off the picture that we just come to a moment in life where we're just all of a sudden complete. But there is a soothing part of the story, and it was at the end of the conversation when I had no more words, which is impressive. I had no more words, no more energy. An observation about the night was that I ended 25 years old. I ended that conversation the same way that I came into the world. I was curled up like an infant on my mom's chest, crying. And my mom was just holding me. And my dad, who was so enraged with me, so disappointed in me, he had made it clearly known that he was not happy with me. He was definitely not happy with the words I was using. He came over and he picked me up and he stood me up. And the same posture that had been turned against me in the night changed. The same voice that was enraged at me turned. And he just pulled me in. He put his big, my dad's 6'2", 250 pounds, he's a big man. He just put his arms around me and he pulled me in. And I can still, to this moment, Sammy, I can feel the warmth of his chest. And he held me there. And I broke. I lost it. I just came limp in his chest, in his hold, in his embrace. I just let myself go and he held me there. And he put, I know it's kind of weird, but if you're a parent, I think you get it. I think I'm going to get it with Ben here later on in life. As a child, I understand it. I understand what my dad was doing. He was being my father. And he held me there in his embrace, and then he put his ear right up to my, I can still feel his breath. He put his mouth right up to my ear. And he said, "Son, it's going to be okay." And it's like I was suspended in the senses of my father. As he whispered to me, he was breathing new life into me. He didn't take then. Oh boy, it took a long time after that. It was just beginning. This was just day one from ground zero. Have you ever experienced the dark night? Have you ever experienced that season of your life where you felt so desperate, so broken? Where you were looking to belong, where you were looking to feel loved, where you were looking to provide pleasure for someone or something. I want to read to you a poem. So cliche of a pastor to do this. This poem comes from the mystic writer, St. John of the Cross. This was written in the 16th century, and it will be up on the screens for you. But it's called The Dark Night of the Soul. I would like to read this to you and then just offer a few words from the gospel passage this morning. We'll be on our way. Here's John's words. On a dark night, kindled in love with yearnings, oh, happy chance, I went forth without being observed, my house being now at rest. In darkness and secure by the secret ladder disguised, oh happy chance, in darkness and in concealment, my house being now at rest, in the happy night, in secret, when none saw me, nor I beheld aught without light or guide save that which burned in my heart. This light guided me more surely than the light of noonday to the place where he, well, I know who, was awaiting me, a place where none appeared. O night that guided me, O night more lovely than the dawn, O night that joined beloved with lover, lover transformed in the beloved, upon my flowery breast kept holy for himself alone, there he stayed sleeping and I caressed him. And the fanning of the cedars made a breeze. The breeze blew from the turret as I parted his locks. With his gentle hand, he wounded my neck and caused all my senses to be suspended. I remained lost in oblivion. My face I reclined on the beloved. All ceased, and I abandoned myself, leaving my cares forgotten amongst the lilies. In a really peculiar scene, a voice comes out from the clouds. I bet everyone there was thinking of Mount Sinai, because everyone there had a good understanding of the Hebrew scriptures. And of course, Moses was there. The cloud being formed around Jesus was not surprising to their knowledge of scriptures. This would have been really familiar to them. The voice coming out of the clouds, they did not, it wasn't whatever voices with the prices right, you know, it's not that person. They understand, they know this voice. This voice is very distinguishable. The voice that comes out of the clouds that surrounds the mountain where Moses is, that voice is always God. And the word that comes out of the cloud that surrounds Moses on a mountain that looks like Mount Sinai, those words are always filled with commandment and law. They know exactly this word. This word is authoritative and it's formative. And here is the word that is used from the authoritative cloud that forms law into being. The word is beloved. This is my beloved. The word beloved means one in a class of their own. No one else like it. no one else to even compare to it. They are in a class of their own. Do you remember when you held the hands of your honey, right? And you had those vows and you said them, and none of us can remember what the heck happened. It was a blur. But we know in that moment with the veil and the minister and the witnesses and our heart pumping and the hands holding and just sweat, just lots of sweat, hands shaking, where's the ring? I don't know where the ring is, where did I put the ring? You know, all that time. And we're saying, you, Jenny Nell, you are in a class of their own. There's been no one like you. There will never be anyone like you. You, Jenny, are my love. You are my beloved. This is what we're saying in that moment, right? And some of us have touched it and we've come close to it. Maybe we haven't shared the vows, but we've experienced it where, man, that person, that thing is in a class of their own. There's no one else like it. There will never be anyone else like it. They are your beloved. Man, it's an exciting thing. This is God, right? He's kind of saying his wedding vows and ways over Jesus. This is one and only. In a class of their own, this is the beloved. And in you, all of the heavenly realms is well pleased in you. Now, all you homies, listen to him. He is my beloved. He is my cherished. He is the one in which all of heaven is well pleased. It's just interesting to me that God chooses him. It's interesting to me that God chooses a Galilean. Galileans weren't even known for being messiahs. There were good things that came from Galilee, right? But when push came to shove, no one in the religious order of that day could recognize that Jesus was good from Galilee. Why? He chose a carpenter. You know, you would think that maybe he would have chose like a Levite or a Pharisee, maybe Nicodemus. Nicodemus would have made a great messiah, Donnie. But why Jesus? Why the man born of a virgin in Bethlehem? Why him? Why the one who can't ever keep straight who's profane and who's unprofane? Who's holy and who's profane? See, around Jesus is always this cloud of witnesses that is just really mucky and murky and yuck. Around him are those who give their life to prostitution. Now, if God is going to choose a beloved and one in which he is well pleased, it's wild to me that he chooses one who others can't even recognize his authority, and that he chooses someone that chooses others that are dirty and that are broken and that are maimed and that are incomplete. Around Jesus is this cloud of people that are looking for love. Around Jesus are these cloud of people that is just desperately wanting someone to say, you are honorable to me. You are complete to me. I believe what God is leading me to understand about the transfiguration is that God reaches from all of the heavens above down to the lowest possible place you could go on earth at that time. See, that the person in which he chooses, Jesus the Christ, that this person, right? This person whom he elects, he goes all the way. You know, Jesus will spend some time in hell. That God, of whom God chooses from all of where God rests, that God goes all the way down, even past the level of prostitution. He goes even deeper than that. He goes down to the belly of the well, down to the very depths of Sheol. That God, from where God reigns and where God lives and where God resides, the person in whom he calls beloved, goes all the way to the depths of yuck. And there, the one whom God calls beloved gathers up all that nasty grime. was speaking in a seminar yesterday, and it was a youth seminar, and I think I will forever be a youth pastor. You have a youth pastor that just happens to preach to you on Sunday mornings, but I will always be a youth pastor. And I was speaking very emphatically. That will surprise you, but I was speaking very emphatically, and someone asked me what the gospel meant. That's what was someone's question yesterday. Jake, what is the gospel? Well, I freaked out. I about fell out of my chair. I was so excited to answer the question. And I was looking for anything to grab, and I think I found a book. And I go, the gospel. The gospel's like this. It's like, this is all the earth, right? This is everyone. This is you. This is me. This is all those people, good and bad. This is the whole earth, everybody. And I will gladly play the part of God, and this is the earth, and I am God, and I think the gospel is where God takes all of the earth and just kind of just brings them in to his chest and holds them there. You see, the God where God resides in all of the earth calls the one beloved who turns himself to the grime of the earth and calls them beloved. And Jesus will hold all of the grime to his chest and suspend them in his breast. And he will whisper to the grime, you are my beloved. And he will hold the grime to his chest when he is flogged and beaten. And the disciples will know because of the transfiguration that the one who's beaten and flogged on Good Friday, that one is the one who holds them to his chest. And in a few days after Golgotha happens, Jesus will be raised from the dead. And he will be joined 40 days later, ascending to the right hand of the Father. And when Jesus raises from the dead, he has in his chest, holding them tight, resting in the chest of the beloved, he has the lover. And the lover is filled full of grime and dirt and shame and nowhere else to go and no one else to love. And yet God gathers them in the person of Jesus Christ to the rest of his embrace. And Jesus will hold us there when he dies for us. And he will hold us there when he resurrects for us. And when Jesus ascends, we will be held tight into the beloved. And when the Son is united with the Father, the God of all heaven will now have in his embrace the scum of all the earth. And it's in that embrace that you, my friends, are adopted into the family of God, and you bear the name Child of God. It is in that embrace that God bends his mouth down to your ear and whispers into it, it will be all right, my child, you are my beloved. It is through the work of Jesus, Amanda, that God gathers you up and calls you good. It is in the work of the Father, Kevin, that God comes to you, in the work of the Son, that God comes to you and restores you to being the beloved. It's an interesting image that St. John the Cross paints for us, isn't it, James? Can you imagine Jesus as the lover, the Father as the beloved? I don't know which scriptural story that will cause you to think of, but the way that St. John the Cross writes it, the lover, we'll call him Jesus, rest in the chest of the beloved, the Father. And the beloved snaps the neck of Jesus, right? To where he is suspended and completely at rest and can only be received by the Father. Isn't that an interesting image? I don't know what scene of scripture that would cause you to think about. There's probably several, but for me, it's the cross. And here is God saying, you are my beloved son, the beloved in whom I'm well pleased. And then he just kind of suspends Jesus, and Jesus claps in the love of the Father, and the Father just lets the son rest on his chest. What peace there is in the unity of the Father and the Son in that moment in which the Son is completely dependent upon the Father's love and on the Father's action. What beautiful embrace it is for us to know that such peace might exist. But what if we switch that scene around and the beloved is the Lord and the lover is you? Have you ever thought about yourself at rest in the chest of the Father, where there is not one thing in which you could do but to receive the embrace of a God who snaps your neck and suspends your senses to rest in him? Thinking about that passage, what would it be like for you to read yourself into the fifth stanza? O night that guided you, O night more lovely than the dawn, O night that joined beloved with lover, lover transformed in the beloved. Friends, I don't know what dark night you may be facing, or what world you may be examining in which everything seems to be turned up dark. But might it be that God not only resides in the dark, but that God becomes Lord in the dark? Could it be that God doesn't only know the dark, but that he's created the dark? Not the evil and the sin, but literally the dark of the night. He created it. Don't you think he knows how to navigate it? And could it be that in the darkness of your pursuit of love, of the be the beloved, that it is in fact God coming to you, pulling you into his chest, looking to suspend you now at rest? Wherever it is that you are finding love, friend, whether it is in your boyfriend, or it is in some online community, or it is in your job, or it may be in some sort of appreciation that you feel like you deserve. I have found that in my life, Drew, that wherever I look for the pursuit of being appreciated, it always turns up empty. In fact, it's like a whirlpool where all of my attention and all of my life and all of my energy is sucked towards trying to satisfy that end, whatever it may be. Whether it's I really want Jenny to show me appreciation this week, and then I give all of my energy and all of my life and all of my identity for Jenny just to tell me that she loves me. See, when the pursuit of being the beloved becomes our identity, well, it's like a whirlpool that sucks all of our life away from us, and we become known as just the one who will pursue at all costs to be beloved. So whether it's in the clothes that you buy, this pursuit will turn up nothing other than lust. So whether it's the clothes you buy or the car you drive or the money you earn or whatever, right? We can really, or the drugs you smoke, it could really be anything, right? And it can even be stuff that's not necessarily classified as bad, like the love of your spouse. But whenever we switch who's the beloved and who's the lover, when we get that relationship wrong, we get sucked into a whirlpool of lust. This morning, as we gather around the table and we're gathered into the meal of Christ, his broken body and his shed blood, what might it be for us to rearrange in our imagination who does the pursuit? What if it's not you pursuing God with all that you've got trying to find love? But what if it's this heavenly realm that knows no other way of being than gathering up the lowest rejected scum of society, reaching out. I'm not necessarily calling you scum. You just may feel that way. You don't look it to me. That God is reaching out to you, gathering you up into him, and he is the beloved, and you are the lover. He is the pursuer, and you are the pursuit. What might it do for your identity to realize that in God, you are the most beautiful thing in all the earth? You are the beloved. Don't you see on the Transfiguration, the craziest thing that's happening, that whenever God speaks to Jesus, he's indirectly speaking to you, because that's how God has relationship with us, is always through Jesus. So whatever words God has for Jesus, he also has for you. Have you ever thought that God sings over you, beloved? That God looks at you, Will, and says, you are my beloved, and you I am well pleased. And you wonder, how can I stand in the presence of God? Well, it's a mystery, my friends. It's called grace, and it's reconciliation. And Jesus at once is taking up all the things that shouldn't be, and all the things that are broken and evil and corrupt, and he's restoring them in his heart. Why? Because you're worth it, you're beloved. And in God you are. He delights in you. He's well pleased by you. Oh boy. Now, let's just get our holiness on for a second. Not only, Kevin, band can come, otherwise I'm going to keep preaching forever, okay? Not only does God gather you up into his heart. I said this last week, and I like it. I'm going to say it again. Not only does God say the sinner's prayer over you and accepts you in his heart. Not only does he do that, but he transforms you so that your heart turns out to be like the beloved. And you, in return, turn to your neighbor, offering them all of the belovedness that God has offered you. What might that do in a culture of division? Who is the scum of the earth to you? Who is your enemy? Who is ugly to you? Who is rejected to you? Friends, to eat at this meal is to be gathered up in the beloved, to have an identity as the beloved, to be beloved. But to eat at this meal is to have your heart changed, to have your life changed. See, to worship with Christ and to have relationship with Christ is to eventually become like Christ, and you yourself will turn to those that are the scum of the earth and you will offer yourselves to them. Why? Because they're worth it and they're loved. And that boss you can't imagine that you would ever love, that little turd of a human being, right? But yet, God, in his divine mercy, looks upon that person and says, that person is my beloved. And we look at God and we say, are you serious? Have you seen what that guy does? He's a jerk. And God says, no. You're not seeing with my eyes. That guy, you should see with my eyes. That guy's my guy. That guy's my beloved. And for us to hang out with Jesus, guess what's going to happen to our eyes? We're going to start seeing that jerk of a boss as beloved. What might happen to our next door neighbor? What might happen to the people in this complex that we may look less favorably on? If we continue to present them to God as if they are the beloved. Not only are we the beloved, Bonnie, not only does God sing yes over you, in Jesus Christ, God's word can't be yes and no. It can only be yes, 2 Corinthians 1:9. It can only be yes. God sings yes over you, Bonnie, yes and yes. But as we are wrapped up into the yes being sung over us, how might God transform us to be the words and the vocalization of yes over the areas of life that only hear no? And I'm not talking necessarily about the easiest people for us to look at and say, you know, like the homeless. Of course, society says no to them. That's obvious. But we often, with our posture, say no to the most powerful in our society. And we treat them as if they're less than beloved. That's not God's words for them. That's not God's words for them. They may look like the enemy to us, but God does not see an enemy. Not in human flesh. God only sees beloved. So what might it look like for us to give our life to Christ in such a way that God turns our posture towards even the people that we hate the most? Well, I fielded a question not too long ago. Why do we do the same things every week? It's practice, man. We're just talking about practice. It's practice. We're going to eat at the table, and we're going to practice what it's going to be like that day that we're all united. When we eat at the table, we all come together, one and the same. We all come, and we're all unified by the love of Christ. Will it happen today, Maria? Will all of your problems with me get solved? Maria doesn't have no problems with me. This is hypothetical. All those problems that Maria has with me, will it get solved today? Probably not. But we're going to practice just like my dad was bringing me into his embrace. And he was practicing the day was going to be all right. It was all going to be all right.